They'd smell the cooking? Clay asked.
Let's just say that we have no desire to find out, the head replied. Have we, Jordan?
No, sir, Jordan said, and took a bite of his second burger. He was slowing down, but Clay thought he'd manage to do his duty.
We want to be inside when they wake up, and inside when they come back from town. That's where they go, to town. They're picking it clean, like birds in a field of grain. That's what the head says.
They were flocking back home earlier when we were in Malden, Alice said. Not that we knew where home for them was. She was eyeing a tray with pudding cups on it.
Can I have one of those?
Yes, indeed.
The head pushed the tray toward her.
And another hamburger, if you'd like. What we don't eat soon will just spoil.
Alice groaned and shook her head, but she took a pudding cup. So did Tom.
They seem to leave at the same time each morning, but the home flocking behavior has been starting later,
Ardai said thoughtfully.
Why would that be?
Slimmer pickings? Alice said.
Perhaps.
He took a final bite of his own hamburger, then covered the remains neatly with a paper napkin.
There are many flocks, you know. Maybe as many as a dozen within a 50-mile radius. We know from people going south that there are flocks in Sandown, Fremont, and Candia. They forage about almost aimlessly in the daytime, perhaps for music as well as food, then go back to where they came from.
You know this for sure? Tom said. He finished one pudding cup and reached for another. Ardai shook his head.
Nothing is for sure, Mr. McCourt.
His hair, a long white tangle, an English professor's hair for sure, Clay thought, rippled a bit in the mild afternoon breeze. The clouds were gone. The back porch gave them a good view of the campus, and so far it was deserted. Jordan went around the house at regular intervals to scout the hill sloping down to Academy Avenue and reported all quiet there as well.
You've not seen any of the other roosting places?
Nope, Tom said.
But we're traveling in the dark, Clay reminded him, and now the dark is really dark.
Yes, the head agreed.
He spoke almost dreamily.
As in Le Moyen Âge.
Translation, Jordan?
The Middle Age, sir.
Good.
He patted Jordan's shoulder. Even big flocks would be easy to miss, Clay said. They wouldn't have to be hiding.
No, they're not hiding,
Headmaster Ardai agreed, steepling his fingers.
Not yet, at any rate. They flock, they forage, and their group mind may break down a bit while they forage, but perhaps less. Every day, perhaps less.
Manchester burned to the ground, Jordan said suddenly. We could see the fire from here, couldn't we, sir?
Yes, the head agreed. It's been very sad and frightening.
Is it true that people trying to cross into Massachusetts are being shot at the border? Jordan asked. That's what people are saying. People are saying you have to go to Vermont. Only that way is safe.
It's a crock, Clay said. We heard the same thing about the New Hampshire border.
Jordan goggled at him for a moment, then burst out laughing. The sound was clear and beautiful in the still air. Then, in the distance, a gun went off. And closer, someone shouted in either rage or horror. Jordan stopped laughing.
Tell us about that weird state they were in last night, Alice said quietly. And the music. Do all the other flocks listen to music at night?
The head looked at Jordan.
Yes, the boy said. It's all soft stuff. No rock, no country. I should guess nothing classical either, the head put in. Not of a challenging nature, at any rate.
It's their lullabies, Jordan said. That's what the head and me think, isn't it, sir?
The head and I, Jordan.
Head and I, yes, sir.
But it is indeed what we think, the head agreed. Although I suspect there may be more to it than that. Yes, quite a bit more.
Clay was flummoxed. He hardly knew how to go on. He looked at his friends and saw in their faces what he was feeling, not just puzzlement, but a dreadful reluctance to be enlightened. Leaning forward, Headmaster Ardai said,
May I be frank? I must be frank. It is the habit of a lifetime. I want you to help us do a terrible thing here. The time to do it is short, I think, and while one such act alone may come to nothing, one never knows, does one? One never knows what sort of communication may flow between these flocks. In any case, I will not stand idly by while these things steal away not only my school, but the very daylight itself. I might have attempted it already, but I'm old, and Jordan is very young, too young. Whatever they are now, they were human not long ago. I won't let him be a part of this.
I can do my share, sir, Jordan said. He spoke as stoutly, Clay thought, as any Muslim teenager who ever strapped on a suicide belt stuffed with explosives.
I salute your courage, Jordan, the head told him, but I think not.
He looked at the boy kindly, but when he returned his gaze to the others, his eyes had hardened considerably.
You have weapons, good ones, and I have nothing but an old single-shot 22 rifle that may not even work anymore, although the barrel's open, I've looked. Even if it does work, the cartridges I have for it may not fire. But we have a gasoline pump at our little motor pool, and gasoline might serve to end their lives.
He must have seen the horror in their faces, because he nodded. To Clay, he no longer looked like kindly old Mr. Chips. He looked like a Puritan elder in an oil painting, one who could have sentenced a man to the stocks without batting an eye, or a woman to be burned at the stake as a witch. He nodded at Clay in particular. Clay was sure of it.
I know what I'm saying. I know how it sounds. But it wouldn't be murder, not really. It would be extermination. And I have no power to make you do anything. But in any case, whether you help me burn them or not, you must pass on a message.
To who? Alice asked faintly.
To everyone you meet, Miss Maxwell.
He leaned over the remains of their meal, those hanging judge eyes sharp and small and burning hot.
You must tell what's happening to them, to the ones who heard the infernal message on their devil's intercoms. You must pass this on. Everyone who has had the daylight robbed away from them must hear, and before it's too late.
He passed a hand over his lower face, and Clay saw the fingers were shaking a little. It would be easy to dismiss that as a sign of a man's age, but he hadn't seen any tremors before.
We're afraid it soon will be, aren't we, Jordan?
Yes, sir.
Jordan certainly thought he knew something. He looked terrified.
What?
What's happening to them? Clay asked. It's got something to do with the music and those wired-together boomboxes, doesn't it? The head sagged, suddenly looking tired.
They're not wired together, he said. Don't you remember me telling you that both of your premises were wrong?
Yes, but I don't understand what you mean.
There's one sound system with a CD in it. About that, you're certainly right. A single compilation disc, Jordan says, which is why the same songs play over and over.
Lucky us, Tom muttered, but Clay barely heard him. He was trying to get the sense of what Ardai had just said. They're not wired together.
How could that be? It couldn't. The sound systems, the boom boxes, if you like, are placed all around the field, the head went on, and they're all on. At night you can see their little red power lamps.
Yes, Alice said. I did notice some red lights. I just didn't think anything of it.
But there's nothing in them. No compact discs or cassette tapes, and no wires linking them. They're just slaves that pick up the master disc audio and rebroadcast it.
If their mouths are open, the music comes from them, too, Jordan said. It's just little, not hardly a whisper, but you can hear it.
No, Clay said. That's your imagination, kiddo. Gotta be.
I haven't heard that myself, Ardai said, but of course my ears aren't what they were back when I was a Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps fan. Back in the day, Jordan and his friends would say.
You're very old school, sir, Jordan said.
He spoke with gentle solemnity and unmistakable affection.
Yes, Jordan, I am, the head agreed.
He clapped the boy on the shoulder, then turned his attention to the others.
If Jordan says he heard it, I believe him.
It's not possible, Clay said, not without a transmitter.
They are transmitting, the head replied. It is a skill they seem to have picked up since the pulse.
Wait, Tom said. He raised one hand like a traffic cop, lowered it, began to speak, raised it again. From his place of dubious shelter at Headmaster Ardai's side, Jordan watched him closely. At last Tom said,
Are we talking telepathy here?
I should guess that's not exactly le mot juste for this particular phenomenon, the head answered. But why stick at technicalities? I would be willing to wager all the frozen hamburgers remaining in my cooler that the word has been used among you before today.
You'd win double burgers, Clay said.
Well, yeah, but the flocking thing is different, Tom said.
Because?
The head raised his tangled brows. Well, because... Tom couldn't finish, and Clay knew why. It wasn't different. The flocking wasn't human behavior, and they'd known it from the moment they'd observed George the mechanic following the woman in the filthy pantsuit across Tom's front lawn to Salem Street. He'd been walking so closely behind her that he could have bitten her neck, but he hadn't. And why? Because for the phone crazies, biting was done. Flocking had begun. At least biting their own kind was done. Unless...
Professor Ardai, at the beginning, they killed everyone.
Yes, the head agreed. We were very lucky to escape, weren't we, Jordan?
Jordan shuddered and nodded.
The kids ran everywhere, even some of the teachers. Killing, biting, babbling nonsense stuff. I hid in one of the greenhouses for a while.
And I in the attic of this very house, the head added. I watched out of the small window up there as the campus I love, literally went to hell.
Jordan said, most of the ones who didn't die ran away toward downtown. Now a lot of them are back, over there. He nodded his head in the general direction of the soccer field. All of which leads us to what? Clay asked.
I think you know, Mr. Riddell.
Clay.
Clay, fine. I think what's happening now is more than temporary anarchy. I think it's the start of a war. It's going to be a short, but extremely nasty one.
Don't you think you're overstating?
I don't. While I have only my observations to go on, mine and Jordan's, we've had a very large flock to observe, and we've seen them going and coming as well as... resting, shall we say. They've stopped killing each other, but they continue to kill the people we would classify as normal. I call that warlike behavior.
You've actually seen them killing normals? Tom asked. Beside him, Alice opened her pack, removed the baby Nike, and held it in her hand. The head looked at him gravely.
I have. I'm sorry to say that Jordan has too.
We couldn't help, Jordan said. His eyes were leaking. There were too many. It was a man and a woman, see? I don't know what they were doing on campus so close to dark, but they sure couldn't have known about Tunney Field. She was hurt. He was helping her along. They ran into about 20 of them on their way back from town. The man tried to carry her. Jordan's voice began to break. On his own he might have gotten away, but with her, he only made it as far as Horton Hall, that's a dorm. That's where he fell down and they caught them. They...
Jordan abruptly buried his head against the old man's coat, a charcoal gray number this afternoon. The head's big hand stroked the back of Jordan's smooth neck.
They seem to know their enemies, the head mused. It may well have been part of the original message, don't you think?
Maybe, Clay said. It made a nasty sort of sense.
As to what they are doing at night as they lie there so still and open-eyed, listening to their music.
The head sighed, took a handkerchief from one of his coat pockets, and wiped the boy's eyes with it in matter-of-fact fashion. Clay saw he was both very frightened and very sure of whatever conclusion he had drawn.
I think they're rebooting, he said.
Chapter 15.
You note the red lamps, don't you?
The head asked in his carrying I will be heard all the way to the back of the lecture hall voice.
I count at least
63—hush up, Tom hissed. He did everything but clap a hand over the old man's mouth. The head looked at him calmly.
Have you forgotten what I said last night about musical chairs, Tom?
Tom, Clay, and Ardai were standing just beyond the turnstiles, with the Tunney Field archway at their backs. Alice had stayed at Cheatham Lodge with Jordan by mutual agreement. The music currently drifting up from the prep school soccer field was a jazz instrumental version of The Girl from Ipanema. Clay thought it was probably cutting-edge stuff if you were a phone crazy.
No, Tom said. As long as the music doesn't stop, we have nothing to worry about. I just don't want to be the guy who gets his throat torn out by an insomniac exception to the rule. You won't.
How can you be so positive, sir? Tom asked.
Because, to make a small literary pun, we cannot call it sleep. Come.
He started down the concrete ramp the players once took to reach the field,
saw that Tom and Clay were hanging back, and looked at them patiently.
"Little knowledge is gained without risk," he said. "And at this point, I would say knowledge is critical, wouldn't you? Come."
They followed his rapping cane down the ramp toward the field, Clay a little ahead of Tom. Yes, he could see the red power lamps of the boomboxes circling the field. 60 or 70 looked about right. Good-sized sound systems, spotted at 10 or 15 foot intervals, each one surrounded with bodies. By starlight, those bodies were an eye-boggling sight. They weren't stacked. Each had his or her own space. But not so much as an inch had been wasted. Even the arms had been interwoven, so that the impression was one of paper dolls carpeting the field, rank on rank, while that music, like something you'd hear in a supermarket, Clay thought, rose in the dark. Something else rose as well, a sallow smell of dirt and rotting vegetables, with a thicker odor of human waste and putrefaction lingering just beneath. The head skirted the goal, which had been pushed aside, overturned, its netting shredded. Here, where the lake of bodies started, lay a young man of about 30 with jagged bite marks running up one arm to the sleeve of his NASCAR t-shirt. The bites looked infected. In one hand he held a red cap that made Clay think of Alice's pet sneaker. He stared dully up at the stars as Bette Midler once more began singing about the wind beneath her wings.
"Hi!"
the head cried in his rusty, piercing voice. He poked the young man briskly in the middle with the tip of his cane, pushing in until the young man broke wind.
"Hi, I say!"
"Stop it!"
Tom almost groaned. The head gave him a look of tight-lipped scorn, then worked the tip of his cane into the cap the young man was holding. He flicked it away. The cap sailed about 10 feet and landed on the face of a middle-aged woman. Clay watched, fascinated, as it slid partially aside, revealing one rapt and blinkless eye. The young man reached up with dreamy slowness and clutched the hand that had been holding the cap into a fist. Then he subsided.
"He thinks he's holding it again," Clay whispered, fascinated.
"Perhaps,"
the head replied, without much interest. He poked the tip of his cane against one of the young man's infected bites. It should have hurt like hell, but the young man didn't react, only went on staring up at the sky as Bette Midler gave way to Dean Martin.
"I could put my cane right through his throat, and he wouldn't try to stop me. Nor would those around him spring to his defense, although in the daytime I have no doubt they'd tear me limb from limb."
Tom was squatting by one of the ghetto blasters.
"There are batteries in this," he said. "I can tell by the weight."
"Yes, in all of them. They do seem to need batteries."
The head considered, then added something Clay could have done without.
"At least so far."
"We could wade right in, couldn't we?" Clay said. "We could wipe them out the way hunters exterminated passenger pigeons back in the 1880s.
The head nodded.
"Bashed their little brains out as they sat on the ground, didn't they? Not a bad analogy. But I'd make slow work of it with my cane. You'd make slow work of it even with your automatic weapon, I'm afraid."
"I don't have enough bullets in any case. There must be..."
Clay ran his eye over the packed bodies again. Looking at them made his head hurt.
"There must be 600 or 700, and that's not even counting the ones under the bleachers."
"Sir? Mr. Ardai?"
It was Tom.
How did you first..."
"How did I determine the depth of this trance state? Is that what you're asking me?"
Tom nodded.
"I came out the first night to observe. The flock was much smaller then, of course. I was drawn to them out of simple but overwhelming curiosity. Jordan wasn't with me. Switching to a nighttime existence has been rather hard for him, I'm afraid."
"You risked your life, you know."
"I had little choice," the head replied. "It was like being hypnotized. I quickly grasped the fact that they were unconscious, even though their eyes were open, and a few simple experiments with the tip of my cane confirmed the depth of the state."
Clay thought of the head's limp, thought of asking him if he'd considered what would have happened to him if he'd been wrong and they'd come after him, and held his tongue. The head would no doubt reiterate what he'd already said. No knowledge obtained without risk. Jordan was right. This was one very old-school dude. Clay certainly wouldn't have wanted to be 14 and standing on his disciplinary carpet. Ardai, meanwhile, was shaking his head at him.
600 or 700's a very low estimate, Clay. This is a regulation-size soccer field. That's 6,000 square yards.
How many?
The way they're packed together? I should say 1,000 at the very least.
And they're not really here at all, are they? You're sure of that?
I am.
And what comes back? A little more each day. Jordan says the same, and he's an acute observer, you may trust me on that. Is not what they were. Which is to say, not human.
Can we go back to the lodge now? Tom asked.
He sounded sick.
Of course, the head agreed.
Just a second, Clay said. He knelt beside the young man in the NASCAR t-shirt. He didn't want to do it. He couldn't help thinking that the hand which had clutched for the red cap would now clutch at him, but he made himself. Down here at ground level, the stink was worse. He had believed he was getting used to it, but he had been wrong. Tom began.
Clay, what are you—
Quiet. Clay leaned toward the young man's mouth, which was partly open. He hesitated, then made himself lean closer, until he could see the dim shine of spit on the man's lower lip.
At first he thought it might only be his imagination, but another 2 inches, he was now almost close enough to kiss the not-sleeping thing with Ricky Craven on its chest. Took care of that.
It's just little, Jordan had said. Not hardly a whisper, but you can hear it. Clay heard it. The vocal, by some trick, just a syllable or two ahead of the one coming from the linked boomboxes. Dean Martin, singing Everybody Loves Somebody Sometime. He stood up, nearly screaming at the pistol-shot sound of his own knees cracking. Tom held up his lantern, looking at him, stare-eyed.
What? What? You're not going to say that kid was...
Clay nodded. Come on. Let's go back. Halfway up the ramp, he grabbed the head roughly by the shoulder. Ardai turned to face him, seemingly not disturbed, to be handled so. You're right, sir. We have to get rid of them. As many as we can, and as fast as we can. This may be the only chance we get. Or do you think I'm wrong?
No, the head replied. Unfortunately, I don't. As I said, this is war, or so I believe. And what one does in war is kill one's enemies. Why don't we go back and talk it over? We could have hot chocolate. I like a tiny splash of bourbon in mine, barbarian that I am.
At the top of the ramp, Clay spared one final look back. Tunney Field was dark, but under strong northern starlight, not too dark to make out the carpet of bodies spread from end to end and side to side. He thought you might not know what you were looking at if you just happened to stumble on it. But once you did... Once you did... His eyes played him a funny trick, and for a moment he almost thought he could see them breathing, all 800 or 1,000 of them, as one organism. That frightened him badly, and he turned to catch up to Tom and Headmaster Ardai, almost running. Chapter 16. The head made hot chocolate in the kitchen, and they drank it in the formal parlor by the light of 2 gas lanterns. Clay thought the old man would suggest they go out to Academy Avenue later on, trolling for more volunteers in Ardai's army, but he seemed satisfied with what he had. The gasoline pump at the motor pool, the head told them, drew from a 400-gallon overhead tank. All they'd have to do was pull a plug. And there were 30-gallon sprayers in the greenhouse, at least a dozen. They could load up a pickup truck with them, perhaps, and back it down one of the ramps. Wait, Clay said. Before we start talking strategy, if you have a theory about all this, sir, I'd like to hear it.
Nothing so formal, the old man said, but Jordan and I have observation, we have intuition, and we have a fair amount of experience between the two of us.
I'm a computer geek, Jordan said over his mug of hot chocolate. Clay found the child's glum assurance oddly charming.
A total McNerd. Been on 'em my whole life, just about. Those things are rebooting, all right. They might as well have software installation please stand by blinking on their foreheads.
I don't understand you, Tom said.
I do, Alice said. Jordan, you think the pulse really was a pulse, don't you? Everyone who heard it, they got their hard drives wiped.
Well, yeah, Jordan said. He was too polite to say, well, duh. Tom looked at Alice, perplexed. Only Clay knew Tom wasn't dumb, and he didn't believe Tom was that slow.
You had a computer, Alice said. I saw it in your little office.
Yes?
And you've installed software, right?
Sure, but...
Tom stopped, looking at Alice fixedly. She looked back.
Their brains? You mean their brains? What do you think a brain is?
Jordan said.
A big old hard drive. Organic circuitry. No one knows how many bytes. Say, giga to the power of a Googleplex. An infinity of bytes.
He put his hands to his ears, which were small and neatly made.
Right in between here.
I don't believe it, Tom said, but he spoke in a small voice, and there was a sick look on his face. Clay thought he did believe it. Thinking back to the madness that had convulsed Boston, Clay had to admit the idea was persuasive. It was also terrible. Millions, perhaps even billions, of brains, all wiped clean at the same time, the way you could wipe an old-fashioned computer disk with a powerful magnet. He found himself remembering Pixie Dark, the friend of the girl with the peppermint-colored cell phone. "Who are you? What's happening?" Pixie Dark had cried. "Who are you? Who am I?" Then she had smacked herself repeatedly in the forehead with the heel of her hand and had gone running full tilt into a lamppost, not once but twice, smashing her expensive orthodontic work to jagged pieces. "Who are you? Who am I?" It hadn't been her cell phone. She had only been listening in and hadn't gotten a full dose. Clay, who thought in images rather than words a good deal of the time, now got a vivid mental picture of a computer screen filling up with those words. "Who are you? Who am I? Who are you? Who am I? Who are you? Who am I? Who are you? Who am I?" And finally at the bottom, as bleak and inarguable as Pixie Dark's fate, "System failure." Pixie Dark is a partially wiped hard drive. It was horrible, but it felt like the stone truth.
"I majored in English, but as a young man I read a great deal of psychology," the head told them. "I began with Freud, of course. Everyone begins with Freud. Then Jung, Adler. Worked my way around the whole ball field from there. Lurking behind all theories of how the mind works is a greater theory, Darwin's. In Freud's vocabulary, the idea of survival as the prime directive is expressed by the concept of the id. In Jung's, by the rather grander idea of blood consciousness. Neither man, I think, would argue with the idea that if all conscious thought, all memory, all ratiocinative ability were to be stripped from a human mind in a moment, what would remain would be pure and terrible."
He paused, looking around for comment. None of them said anything. The head nodded, as if satisfied, and resumed.
"Although neither the Freudians nor the Jungians come right out and say it, they strongly suggest that we may have a core, a single basic carrier wave, or, to use language with which Jordan is comfortable, a single line of written code which cannot be stripped."
"The PD," Jordan said. "The prime directive."
"Yes," the head agreed. "At bottom, you see, we are not Homo sapiens at all. Our core is madness. The prime directive is murder. What Darwin was too polite to say, my friends, is that we came to rule the earth not because we were the smartest or even the meanest, but because we have always been the craziest, most murderous motherfuckers in the jungle. And that is what the pulse exposed 5 days ago."
Chapter 17. "I refuse to believe that we were lunatics and murderers before we were anything else," Tom said. "Christ, man, what about the Parthenon? What about Michelangelo's David? What about that plaque on the moon that says, 'We came in peace for all mankind'?"
"That plaque also has Richard Nixon's name on it,"
Ardai said dryly.
"A Quaker, but hardly a man of peace. Mr. McCourt, Tom, I have no interest in handing down an indictment of mankind. If I did, I'd point out that for every Michelangelo there's a Marquis de Sade, for every Gandhi an Eichmann, for every Martin Luther King an Osama bin Laden. Leave it at this. Man has come to dominate the planet thanks to two essential traits. One is intelligence. The other has been the absolute willingness to kill anyone and anything that gets in his way.
He leaned forward, surveying them with his bright eyes.
Mankind's intelligence finally trumped mankind's killer instinct, and reason came to rule over mankind's maddest impulses. That, too, was survival. I believe the final showdown between the two may have come in October of 1963, over a handful of missiles in Cuba. But that is a discussion for another day. The fact is, most of us had sublimated the worst in us until the pulse came along and stripped away everything but that red core.
Someone let the Tasmanian devil out of its cage, Alice murmured.
Who?
That need not concern us either, the head replied. I suspect they had no idea of what they were doing, or how much they were doing. Based upon what must have been hurried experiments over a few years, perhaps even months, they may have thought they would unleash a destructive storm of terrorism. Instead, they unleashed a tsunami of untold violence, and it's mutating. Horrible as the current days may now seem, we may later view them as a lull between one storm and the next. These days may also be our only chance to make a difference.
What do you mean, mutating? Clay asked. But the head didn't answer. Instead, he turned to 12-year-old Jordan.
If you please, young man.
Yes, well, Jordan paused to think.
Your conscious mind only uses a tiny percentage of your brain's capacity. You guys know that, right?
Yes, Tom said, a bit indulgently.
So I've read.
Jordan nodded.
Even when you add in all the autonomic functions they control, plus the subconscious stuff, dreams, blink think, the sex drive, all that jazz, our brains are barely ticking over.
Holmes, you astound me, Tom said.
Don't be a wise ass, Tom, Alice said,
and Jordan gave her a decidedly starry-eyed smile.
I'm not, Tom said. The kid is good.
Indeed he is, the headmaster said dryly. Jordan may have occasional problems with the King's English, but he did not get his scholarship for excelling at Tiddlywinks.
He observed the boy's discomfort and gave Jordan's hair an affectionate scruff with his bony fingers.
Continue, please.
Well,
Jordan struggled, Clay could see it, and then seemed to find his rhythm again.
If your brain really was a hard drive, the can would be almost empty.
He saw only Alice understood this.
Put it this way. The info strip would say something like 2% in use, 98% available. No one has any real idea what that 98% is for, but there's plenty of potential there. Stroke victims, for instance, they sometimes access previously dormant areas of their brains in order to walk and talk again. It's like their brains wire around the blighted area. The lights go on in a similar area of the brain, but on the other side.
You study this stuff? Clay asked.
It's a natural outgrowth of my interest in computers and cybernetics, Jordan said, shrugging. Also, I read a lot of cyberpunk science fiction. William Gibson, Bruce Sterling, John Shirley.
Neal Stephenson? Alice asked.
Jordan grinned radiantly.
Neal Stephenson's a god!
Back on message, the head chided, but gently.
Jordan shrugged.
If you wipe a computer hard drive, it can't regenerate spontaneously, except maybe in a Greg Bear novel.
He grinned again, but this time it was quick, and Clay thought rather nervous. Part of it was Alice, who clearly knocked the kid out.
People are different. But there's a huge leap between learning to walk again after a stroke and being able to power a bunch of boomboxes by telepathy, Tom said. A quantum leap.
He looked around self-consciously as the word telepathy came out of his mouth, as if expecting them to laugh. No one did.
Yeah, but a stroke victim, even someone who has a bad one, is light years different from what happened to people who were on their cells during the pulse, Jordan replied. Me and the head and I, think that in addition to stripping people's brains all the way to that one unerasable line of code, the pulse also kicked something on. Something that's probably been sitting inside all of us for millions of years, buried in that 98% of dormant hard drive.
Clay's hand stole to the butt of the revolver he had picked up off the floor in Beth Nickerson's kitchen. "A trigger," he said. Jordan lit up.
"Yeah, exactly. A mutative trigger. It never could have happened without this, like, total erasure on a grand scale. Because what's emerging, what's building up in those people out there, only they're no longer people, what's building up is..."
"It's a single organism," the head interrupted. "This is what we believe."
"Yes, but more than just a flock," Jordan said. "Because what they can do with the CD players may only be the start, like a little kid learning to put his shoes on. Think about what they might be able to do in a week, or a month, or a year."
"You could be wrong," Tom said, but his voice was dry as a breaking stick.
"He could also be right," Alice said. "Oh, I'm sure he's right," the head put in.
He sipped his spiked hot chocolate.
"Of course, I'm an old man, and my time is almost over in any case. I'll abide by any decision you make."
A slight pause. The eyes flicked from Clay to Alice to Tom.
"As long as it's the right one, of course."
Jordan said, "The flocks will try to come together, you know. If they don't hear each other already, they will real soon."
"Crap," Tom said uneasily. "Ghost stories."
"Maybe," Clay said. "But here's something to think about. Right now the nights are ours. What if they decide they need less sleep, or that they're not afraid of the dark?"
No one said anything for several moments. A wind was rising outside. Clay sipped his hot chocolate, which had never been much more than tepid, and was now almost cold. When he looked up again, Alice had put hers aside and was holding her Nike talisman instead.
"I want to wipe them out," she said. "The ones on the soccer field. I want to wipe them out. I don't say kill them because I think Jordan's right, and I don't want to do it for the human race. I want to do it for my mother and my dad. Because he's gone, too. I know he is. I feel it. I want to do it for my friends Vicky and Tess. They were good friends, but they had cell phones. They never went anywhere without them. And I know what they're like now and where they're sleeping. Someplace just like that fucking soccer field."
She glanced at the head, flushing.
"Excuse me, sir."
The head waved her apology away.
"Can we do that?" she asked him. "Can we wipe them out?"
Charles Ardye, who had been winding down his career as Gayton Academy's interim headmaster when the world ended, bared his eroded teeth in a grin Clay would have given much to have captured with pen or brush. There was not a single ounce of pity in it.
"Miss Maxwell, we can try," he said.
Chapter 18. At 4 o'clock the next morning, Tom McCourt sat on a picnic table between the two Gayton Academy greenhouses, which had both sustained serious damage since the pulse. His feet, now wearing the Reeboks he'd donned back in Malden, were on one of the benches, and his head lay on his arms, which rested on his knees. The wind blew his hair first one way, then the other. Alice sat across from him with her chin propped on her hands and the rays of several flashlights striking angles and shadows across her face. The harsh light made her look pretty in spite of her obvious weariness. At her age, all light was still flattering. The head, sitting next to her, only looked exhausted. In the closer of the two greenhouses, two Coleman gas lanterns floated like uneasy spirits. The Colemans converged at the near end of the greenhouse. Clay and Jordan used the door, although huge holes in the glass paneling had been opened on either side. A moment later, Clay sat down next to Tom and Jordan resumed his usual spot next to the head. The boy smelled of gasoline and fertilizer, even more strongly of dejection. Clay dropped several sets of keys on the table amid the flashlights. As far as he was concerned, they could stay there until some archaeologist discovered them 4 millennia from now.
"I'm sorry," Headmaster Ardye said softly. "It seemed so simple."
"Yeah," Clay said. It had seemed simple. Fill the greenhouse sprayers with gasoline, load the sprayers into the back of a pickup truck, drive across Tunney Field, wetting down both sides as they went, toss a match. He thought to tell Ardye that George W. Bush's Iraq adventure had probably looked equally simple. Load the sprayers, toss a match, and didn't. It would have been pointlessly cruel. Tom? Clay asked. You okay? He had already realized that Tom didn't have great reserves of stamina. Yeah, just tired. He raised his head and gave Clay a smile. Not used to the night shift. What do we do now? Go to bed, I guess, Clay said. It'll be dawn in another 40 minutes or so. The sky had already begun to lighten in the east.
It's not fair, Alice said. She brushed angrily at her cheeks. It's not fair. We tried so hard.
They had tried hard, but nothing had come easily. Every small and ultimately meaningless victory had been the sort of maddening struggle his mother had called a bullshit shit pull. Part of Clay did want to blame the head, also himself, for not taking Ardai's sprayer idea with a grain of salt. Part of him now thought that going along with an elderly English teacher's plan to firebomb a soccer field was a little like taking a knife to a gunfight. Still, yeah, it had seemed like a good idea. Until, that was, they discovered the motor pool's gasoline storage tank was inside a locked shed. They'd spent nearly half an hour in the nearby office, scrounging by lantern light through maddeningly unmarked keys on a board behind the superintendent's desk. It was Jordan who finally found the key that unlocked the shed door. Then they discovered that one would only have to pull a plug was not exactly the case. There was a cap, not a plug. And like the shed in which the tank resided, the cap was locked. Back to the office. Another scrounge by lantern light. Finally a key that did indeed seem to fit the cap. It was Alice who pointed out that since the cap was on the bottom of the tank, assuring gravity feed in case of a power outage, they would have a flood on their hands without a hose or a siphon. They spent an hour looking for a hose that might fit and couldn't find anything that looked even close. Tom found a small funnel, which sent them all into moderate hysterics. And because none of the truck keys were marked, at least in ways non-motor pool employees could understand, locating the right set became another process of trial and error. This one went faster, at least, because there were only 8 trucks parked behind the garage. And last, the greenhouses. There they discovered only 8 sprayers, not a dozen, with a capacity of not 30 gallons each, but 10. They might be able to fill them from the gasoline storage tank, but they would be drenched in the process, and the result would be a mere 80 gallons of usable, sprayable gas. It was the idea of wiping out 1,000 phone crazies with 80 gallons of regular that had driven Tom, Alice, and the head out to the picnic bench. Clay and Jordan had hung in a while longer, looking for bigger sprayers, but they had found none. "We found a few little leaf sprayers, though," Clay said. "You know, what they used to call flit guns." "Also," Jordan said, "the big sprayers in there are all full of weed killer or plant food or something. We'd have to start by dumping them all out, and that would mean putting on masks just to make sure we didn't gas ourselves or something." "Reality bites," Alice said morosely. She looked at her baby sneaker for a moment, then tucked it away in her pocket. Jordan picked up the keys they had matched to one of the maintenance pickups. "We could drive downtown," he said. "There's a trustworthy hardware. They must have sprayers." Tom shook his head. "It's over a mile, and the main drag's full of wrecks and abandoned vehicles. We might be able to get around some, but not all. And driving over the lawns is out of the question. The houses are just too close together. There are reasons everybody's on foot." They had seen a few people on bicycles, but not many. Even the ones equipped with lights were dangerous if ridden at any speed.
"Would it be possible for a light truck to negotiate the side streets?" the head asked.
Clay said, "We could explore the possibility tomorrow night, I suppose. Scout out a path in advance on foot and come back for the truck." He considered. They'd probably have all sorts of hose in a hardware store, too.
"You don't sound exactly jazzed," Alice said.
Clay sighed. "It doesn't take much to block little streets. We'd end up doing a lot of donkey work, even if we got luckier than we did tonight."
"I just don't know. Maybe it'll look better to me after some rest."
"Of course it will," the head agreed, but he sounded hollow. "To all of us."
"What about the gas station across from the school?"
Jordan asked without much hope.
What gas station? Alice asked.
He's talking about the Citgo, the head replied. Same problem, Jordan. Plenty of gasoline in the tanks under the pumps, but no power. And I doubt if they have much in the way of containers beyond a few 2 or 5 gallon gasoline cans. I really think...
But he didn't say what he really thought. He broke off.
What is it, Clay?
Clay was remembering the trio ahead of them limping past that gas station, one of the men with an arm around the woman's waist.
Academy Grove Citgo, he said. That's the name, isn't it?
Yes.
But they didn't just sell gasoline, I think.
He didn't just think, he knew. Because of the 2 trucks parked on the side. He had seen them, and hadn't thought anything of them. Not then he hadn't, no reason to.
I don't know what you...
The head began, then stopped. His eyes met Clay's. His eroded teeth once more made their appearance in that singularly pitiless smile.
Oh, he said. Oh, oh my. Oh my, yes.